You're listening to international investment advisor Doug Goldstein on the Goldstein on Gelt show, the financial show where we'll talk about how you can make the most of your money. With all the confusing financial chatter bombarding you each and every day, Goldstein on Gelt will give you the practical information you want and need about living a financially stable life. Here's your host, money maven Doug Goldstein.
Okay, we are back. I'm very happy to have on the Goldstein on Gelt show Dr. Christopher Sims, who's a professor of economics at Princeton University. He's also a member of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences and is the co-winner with Thomas Sargent of the 2011 Nobel Prize in Economics. Dr. Sims, it's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here.
Over the years, you've published papers and researched a great deal in what's referred to as econometrics and macroeconomic theory. Before we go into your theories, could you just describe, maybe in layman's terms, what's this all about?
Well, macroeconomics studies economy-wide variables like GDP, total employment, interest rates, inflation, and econometrics is the use of the bringing to bear economics on interpretation of data. So much of my work has been on trying to understand the messages that economic data at the national level are telling us.
Okay. And some of the work that you've done has been written up. It's in fact, I think what your Nobel Prize was focusing to some extent was how you helped to use statistics so that people could distinguish between different major schools of thought in the economy, described, I guess, generally as the monetarists and the Keynesians. How did you help with that?
Well, my work went through some stages. The first thing I did that got a lot of attention was checking the assertion of the monetarists that trying to explain inflation by looking at the recent past history of money growth was a legitimate causal exercise. In other words, when you looked at statistical correlations of money growth with future inflation, could you interpret that as showing that money growth was causing inflation? And that's a difficult question because money growth tends to increase when inflation increases anyway.
But they're not necessarily correlated?
So they're correlated, but they're not. That's not necessarily causal. And I pointed it out, an insight that some people had already seen in other areas, that it is possible to test one of the implications of that relationship being causal. And so this paper tested that and showed that it passed the test, which the monetarists were very happy with. But then over the next few years, I and some students noticed that when you began to look at interest rate data as well as money supply data, similar tests started giving a different answer. So that led me to start working with multiple variables at a time instead of just two, particular interest rates, inflation, and output growth. And when I started working in systems like that, I found that it was possible to separate out deliberate policy changes and their effects on interest rates and money from the passive response of interest rates and money to the state of the economy. And there one found that it wasn't mainly monetary policy changes that were producing changes in inflation and output growth, though they did have an effect. So the result was neither a complete win for monetarists nor a complete win for the old-fashioned version of Keynesians.
Okay, so you're saying that you were able to isolate certain policies that then seem to be causative or somehow affect inflation. Okay, so given the amount of noise in the economic world, there's so many different variables. It's never just three or four. It could be 300 or 400 at a time. Do you feel confident, or can one feel confident, that he can actually isolate a certain a a certain factor?
Well, one of the things that I did that was different from other methodology at the time was to avoid imposing assumptions of convenience on the models I was fitting to data. The traditional way to proceed was to, whenever an effect looked statistically marginal, just set it to zero. And in what I was doing, I recognized that a lot of these things that were being set to zero were actually uncertain. Mm-hmm. And the result was that my results about isolating causal effects have big standard errors. That is, you can't say with 100% certainty that what I found is really there. It's more like 80-20.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always the case with economists, right? In other words, by definition, they give you a probability of an event. They're not going to tell you yes or no.
Right, but the formal models I was using were more honest about these probabilities than the formal models that people had been using before. I guess that's the way to put it. Mm-hmm. Of course, when economists talk about the results of their models, they generally discount a little bit the results of the models. So when it came down to how policymakers used them, it wasn't such a big change.
Okay. We are talking with Dr. Chris Sims from Princeton. He's the 2011 Nobel Prize winner, along with Thomas Sargent. And some of the work that he's done has actually helped people to take theories that had been believed one way or the other and apply real statistical modeling to see if they were actually accurate. I think that specifically the area you were working with between the monetarists and the Keynesians is often seen as the split between the right wing and the left wing. Do you think that's an appropriate distinction to make?
Not at all, especially these days. It was probably an appropriate distinction to make in about 1953. But now I'd say the leading new Keynesians in the profession there's a term called new Keynesians, who are people who, economists who accept many of the basic insights of Keynes, but have also incorporated rational expectations and many other modern developments in economics. And these new Keynesians, many of them are forthright Republicans. Greg Mankiw, who was an advisor to Bush, Ben Bernanke, the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board in the U.S., has been a Republican for his whole life, as far as I know, and he's a leading new Keynesian.
Mm-hmm. It would seem that, just to apply me, I know that a lot of the work you do is more theoretical, but as this is a personal finance show, I want people to walk away with an idea of what might happen or maybe what they could take home from this. So I'm curious, there seems to be a Keynesian approach that some would say to the economic policy currently in the U.S., which is borrowing a lot in order to improve the economy. And there's a strong argument that could be made that over the past few years, since the real estate bubble and the crash, things have improved and the debt's increased a great deal. Is that any sort of empirical proof that that they were right?
Well, it does seem to be true that the U.S., in contrast to Britain and the euro area, has recovered from the crisis a little better, and it has followed looser budgetary policies. And I think that all bears out the Keynesian idea that in a depression, it's not smart to drastically reduce government spending and deficits. Of course, the U.S. and most countries in the advanced world have aging populations and very serious long-run budget problems. But the way to handle those long-run budget problems isn't to make drastic across-the-board cuts in government spending in the middle of a depression.
Mm-hmm. That begs the question, then. What would be the way to deal with the ever-increasing huge debt?
Well, In the U.S., we've got lots of room to increase taxes. We have, by rich economy standards, a pretty low rate of taxation, though it seems very difficult politically to do that. And if we don't do that, we have to find ways to slow the growth of spending on medical care for the elderly and on retirement. And politically, it seems very difficult to do that. I think it's not technically difficult to describe a program that would provide stimulus in the short run and resolve our long-run budget difficulties. The problem is any such program involves winners and losers, mm-hmm. and as soon as they go, the program goes before a Democratic body, it gets stuck in the battle over who's going to win and who's going to lose.
So given that reality, is your prognosis at all optimistic for the Western economies?
I think we will get over it. The U.S. in particular, I don't see how the stalemate in Congress can go on indefinitely. Some people, especially my co-winner Tom Sargent, likes to say, budget constraints are constraints. They get satisfied one way or another. So it will work out. I'm a little more concerned about Europe, where I think their institutional structure just has gaps that they are not recognizing and not filling, and they could end up giving themselves several decades of very slow growth if they don't change their approach.
So you referred to institutional problems in Europe. What do you mean by that?
The Europeans set up a European-wide central bank without any corresponding European-wide fiscal institutions. And currencies, fiat currencies, as are used in all the rich economies, require fiscal backing. The fiscal backing isn't explicit or operative all the time. It has to be there as a backstop. And
you mean instead of just having Germany there to bail them out?
Yeah, Germany doesn't want to be in the position. If Germany is in the position of being the fiscal backstop, it creates very bad incentives for the other countries in Europe, and the Germans understand this. Inflation in budget deficits in one country can create inflationary pressures throughout Europe in the current arrangement. And unless some other country steps up to fill the gap, there could be Europe-wide inflation. But if another country steps up to fill the gap when one European country runs deficits, you end up creating incentives for bad fiscal policy. And the Germans understand that. What they need is some political mechanism for sharing risk. When something bad happens to one country, there should be fiscal flows that are automatic and pre-negotiated, mm-hmm. as there are in the U.S. If one state in the U.S. Has a severe shock, our nationwide income tax and unemployment insurance creates fiscal flows into that state. There needs to be something like that in Europe.
Sounds like they could use some more advice from you, but I hear that. Unfortunately, we're just about out of time. We've been talking to Dr. Chris Sims, who is a professor of economics at Princeton University, and he won the 2011 Nobel Prize in Economics. Dr. Sims, in the last few seconds, could you just tell people, how can they follow your work?
I have a web page at www.princeton.edu/Sims, S-I-M-S. And I post my working paper drafts on that. In fact, most of my publications are available through that web page.
Okay. Dr. Sims, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Goldstein on Gelt show with money maven Doug Goldstein. Doug's weekly radio show is heard around the world, but if you miss it, you can download the podcast at www.goldsteinongelt.com. The Goldstein on Gelt show gives you up-to-date financial ideas so you can get on the path to financial freedom. If you'd like your questions answered on the air or off, send Doug an email to doug@profile-financial.com. It's your money for your future, so join Doug every week to build your wealth on the Goldstein on Gelt show.